Okay, some manuscript evidence of the New Testament. Originally, of course, the Old Testament was in Hebrew with some Aramaic, but the New Testament is written in Greek. It was written in Asia, Europe, and Africa. It has 9 writers and was all written in about 40 years. Josh McDowell says, how much notice is taken of an ancient manuscript or document depends on the number of manuscript copies we have, the time interval between the original being written and the first copy we have, and how accurate the copies are. So our first question is, how much have we got of the New Testament? And the answer is we have 25,000 manuscript copies of portions of the New Testament. Just over 5,000 of them are Greek manuscripts, that's the original language. And in the translations, 10,000 are in Latin, most from the Latin Vulgate. The Vulgate was the Bible translated by Jerome into Latin in the 4th century AD, which, after revisions, became the Roman Catholic Bible. And then we have 9,900 manuscripts in Latin, Slavic, Arabic, Anglo-Saxon, and many other languages, including Syrian and Coptic. These are manuscripts too. Altogether, 24,970 manuscript portions of the New Testament extant. Some, yes, are fragments, but many of them are chunks of books, or whole books, or even nearly the whole Bible. 10% of all Greek manuscripts that exist are Bible documents. And we know that the New Testament is probably more than 98% reliable, at least 98%, probably more. Homer's Iliad comes next. His manuscripts, or the manuscripts of that book, form 1% of all Greek documents. And the text of it is 95% reliable. So 25,000 copies of bits of the New Testament. How many secular manuscripts do we have? 5 copies of Aristotle, 7 copies of Plato, 20 of Tacitus, 7 of Pliny the Younger, 8 of Herodotus, 10 of Julius Caesar. The New Testament manuscripts, the earliest is a fragment from 125 AD, written 40 years after the original. And the first full text of the New Testament, which is actually the first full text of the Bible, is the Codex Vaticanus, 250 years after the canon was complete. The nearest ancient document is again Homer's Iliad. There are 634 copies of that. And the earliest fragment again, is a 2nd century AD fragment, more than 900 years after he'd written it. And the first full text we have of the Iliad is 10th century AD, 1800 years later. So this is how close to the original the New Testament is, and the nearest ancient document is the Iliad. So, other secular texts, you can see Aristotle. The earliest copy we have is 1100 AD, 1430 years after he wrote it. Plato, 900 AD, 1200 years later. Tacitus, 1100, 900 years later. Pliny, 850, 750 years later. Herodotus, 900, 1300 years later. And Caesar, 900, 1,000 years later. Bruce Metzger, has said the works of several ancient authors are preserved to us by the thinnest possible thread of transmission. In contrast, the textual critic of the New Testament is embarrassed by the wealth of his material. Sir Frederick Kenyon, former director and principal librarian of the British Museum, wrote of the New Testament, "The interval between the dates of original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be in fact negligible. and the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as established. We have very early copies of the New Testament. And what are these ancient New Testament manuscripts? The oldest are papyri. There are 88 of them written in Greek. The oldest is here in Manchester in the John Rylands, 5 verses from John 18, written on both sides of a fragment, dated from about 125 AD. The next is Bodmer II, about 150 AD, contains 92% of John's Gospel. And the three papyri codices, a codex is a manuscript bound like a modern book, not like a scroll. So three papyri codices dated about 130 AD, which contain parts of the Gospels, the Book of Acts, most of Paul's letters and the Hebrews, and a couple of pages of Revelation. And Bodmer 14:15, most of Luke and John, and we have 102 out of the original 144 leaves, 87% identical to Codex Vaticanus, 92% identical in John. The Chester Beatty and Bodmer papyri between them, written between 125 and 150 AD, contain between 40% of the New Testament. The next oldest things are parchments made from sheep or goat skin and used for important documents only. The oldest codices, remember they're books, which contain most of the Old Testament and New Testament, are the Codex Vaticanus, written down in 325 or between 325 and 350 AD, produced in Egypt, small and delicate unsealed letters on fine vellum. Vellum's expensive deer hide. Now in the Vatican, hence its name, contains all of the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, but it only has a fragment of Genesis, and that's the trouble with books. You tend to lose pages from the front and the back, as you might know. It only has 32 Psalms, but it has all of the New Testament as far as Hebrews 9. One scribe copied the Old Testament, and one the New Testament. And the Codex Sinaiticus, half the Old Testament, again, 325 to 350 AD, it was found in St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai by a French count. He found the monks were using it, using some of its pages to light their fires. It contains most of the Bible, half of the Old Testament, all the New Testament, except the disputed passages in John 7 to 8 and Mark 16, plus two apocryphal books. You'll remember that the Septuagint originally included the Apocrypha, while the Hebrew version didn't. This is now in London, and there were three scribes for this book. In 251 AD, there was a severe persecution of Christians by the Emperor Decius, and during that, many Christian documents were destroyed. Most of them that survived that destruction are of the four Gospels and Acts. But dating to before 251, we also have early fragments of all the books, except Jude and Revelation, and we have fragments of them soon after 251. Dating the documents, occasionally by carbon dating, believed to be accurate within 20 years. Sometimes the copyist dated it, or mentioned an event whose date you know, like the fall of Jerusalem. The handwriting can be compared with the handwriting of known date, such as documents in Pompeii, which can't be later than the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79. Sometimes the date of a correction is known, which means the original is earlier. Scribes began writing in books, in codices, at the end of the first century. We have something called the Magdalene manuscripts, of a few verses in Matthew, all in capitals, which means it's early, but it was part of a book. So it was therefore probably towards the end of the first century. But the handwriting was similar to that found in Pompeii and Herculaneum in AD 79. So some people date it to AD 50 and others for AD 100. And for convenience, it's usually dated the same as the John Rylands papyrus. Parchments come later than most papyri. And the first parchment we have, is late 2nd century, 14 verses, Acts 5. Now I'm going to quickly look at the rest of the objections. Objection number 3. We don't know what the original version of the New Testament contained because it's been changed and added to over the centuries. But in addition to the 25,000 manuscripts we have, which of course can be compared with one another, we have 32,000 citations of the New Testament from the Church Fathers who were writing before the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. These early Church Fathers quoted almost every verse of the New Testament, or every verse of the New Testament except 20. They made extensive references to the Old Testament and New Testament in both Greek and Latin, and they also interpreted and explained them so we can see how they understood the Greek. We have the Epistle of Clement to the Corinthians, AD 95. He quotes from the Gospels, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, Ephesians, Titus, Hebrews, and 1 Peter, and does not quote from any non-canonical book. Ignatius, writing in AD 115, quotes from Matthew, John, and 9 of Paul's letters. These two writers alone quote from 15 New Testament books, leading us to believe the New Testament was completed in the first century, and probably mostly before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, because no New Testament book records the destruction of the temple. Polycarp, writing in 115 AD 2, cites all four Gospels. Origen, who was born in AD 185, refers to all the New Testament as we have it today. Bruce Metzger says, so extensive are these citations that if all the other sources for our knowledge of the text of the New Testament were destroyed, these would be sufficient alone for the reconstruction of practically the entire New Testament. In addition, Eusebius, writing in the mid-3rd century, about 250 AD, puts all the books of the New Testament canon into three categories. Those universally accepted, that's most of them, and the authorship, but not the validity, disputed by some. And he mentions Jude, 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, and a few had questioned the writer of Revelation. He included James in his list, but the Church Fathers found that the Syriac version of the New Testament included the book of James, and as James was the bishop of Syria, his epistle was accepted. And the third category, Eusebius puts in those rejected by Christians as false, and he includes many of those mentioned in the Da Vinci Code, hoaxes, late works, but none of the New Testament. We have many early translations. The more manuscripts and the more translations there were, the more it had spread, the harder it would be for the church to recall and change it. In fact, in a very short time, it was impossible. Plus, remember that a translation fixes the text it was translating from. The New Testament was soon translated into these languages for which we have manuscript evidence: Syriac, Coptic, Armenian. Their New Testament includes a letter from Corinth to Paul and a third letter of Paul to Corinth. The Armenians were the first officially Christian country. Georgian, Arabic. The earliest copy we have is 867 AD. It uses Allah for God, but Jerome's Latin translation made use of 2nd century Arabic documents, we know. Gothic and many others. Objection number 4. There are huge numbers of errors in the copying, so the text we have is seriously corrupt, and scribes change the text for theological reasons. Well, we've already seen that the transmission of the Old Testament in the last 2,000 years is at least 95% accurate as Homer. For the New Testament, we are 98% certain of the New Testament. Half of all variants are 1 to 2 words. Almost all of them are spelling, not changes of meaning. Where doubt creeps in because of a variant, the doctrine is confirmed in other passages. Westcott and Hawke say, if comparative trivialities such as changes of order, the insertion or omission of the definite article or indefinite article, with proper names and the like are set aside, the words still subject to doubt can hardly amount to more than 1,000th part of the New Testament. Of the variants, most are accidental typos, shown by no pattern and often corrected by other scribes. Many manuscripts have Jesus Christ, where others have Christ Jesus. But there are 38 places with larger changes. The most important are the end of Mark 16. The Codex Vaticanus doesn't have it, but it does have a blank space for it, and it's the only space in it. The Codex Sinaiticus has a similar blank. Apparently you can see where the end of Mark has been pumiced out. Seven verses are missing from Sinaiticus but present in Vaticanus. Two missing from Vaticanus but present in Sinaiticus. And both of them lack 13 verses we now have. And there's the problem of the end of John and the beginning of John 7 and beginning of John 8, which nobody seems very sure about. Okay, it's often alleged that the powerful Roman Catholic Church devised the canon, that it decided which books were to be in the New Testament, and they decided this, it is said, at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, where they suppressed works which would undermine its power. Did this actually happen? And what evidence have you got? I'm going to give you 3 minutes to get into your groups and discuss this. I'm going to tell you again what it said, what I just said. It's often alleged that the powerful Roman Catholic Church devised the canon, that it decided which books were to be in the New Testament at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, and it suppressed works which would undermine its power. Did this happen, as people who've read Dan Brown would say? What evidence have you got? 3 minutes. Okay, so did the Council of Nicaea suppress works which would undermine its power? What answers have we got? Charles.
Well, persecution of the church had only just ended because Constantine had only recently become emperor around, was it 313 AD? And so whoever's thinking that in 12 years the Roman Catholic Church has grown into this huge, sinister organisation that's just come out from the catacombs, mostly the evidence of torture still on their bodies, and they're still fighting with the whole Roman pantheon.
This is correct, actually. The evidence of torture on their bodies. There were 318 bishops at the Council of Nicaea, and lots of them had lost bits of their arms and bits of their legs. So it was commented on the time that, you know, virtually all of them had the marks of persecution on them. Good point, thank you. Does anybody know what the Council of Nicaea was about?
It was about Athanasius' heresy, wasn't it?
It was the Athanasian heresies. It was about whether Jesus was fully divine, and it wasn't about the canon. What are they thinking of when they say the Council of Nicaea? What do they really mean? Does anybody know? You don't have to know this. I just thought you might know this.
Athanasius was the one who stood for the gospel.
Yes, thank you, you are quite right, thank you for the correction. What council, though, are they, or synod, are they thinking of when they're talking about the canon being discussed, canon of scripture? Does anybody know that? Just thought you might all be yelling at me here. I know this anyway, what you're telling me for. Okay, what they're thinking about is the Third Synod of Carthage. So it's not Rome anyway, it's North Africa. 397 AD, where they agreed to limit the reading of scripture just to the canonical books traditionally read in Carthage in North Africa, and lists what they are. And the list contains the books of the Bible and the Apocrypha. The Pope wasn't there at Nicaea, by the way. He was too old. He only sent reps. Anyway, but even the synod didn't compose the canon. We have evidence that it already existed and had done since the end of the first century, at least. They only confirmed the canon. And remember the evidence from the early church father who had already quoted the whole of the canonical books. Okay, I've actually missed objection number 5, so I'm going to launch that. We're going to come back to this in a minute, I hope. Okay, our manuscripts have been made up from fragments that have been cobbled together to alter the meaning. Well, that's not true, but how do we know that all the pages in a document are in fact from the same document? We have various tests. We can compare the handwriting. Is it in capitals? Has it used uncial or minuscule? We can look at the width of pages, the number of columns on a page, how many lines in a column, how many letters in a line. Do they have similar punctuation and paragraphing? Were they bought in the same city? Do they use the same sacred abbreviation? Some schools of copyists abbreviated words such as God, Lord, Jesus Christ, and others abbreviated words like Son, Father, Man, Cross, Crucify, because they felt they were too sacred. And then we could ask, do they have finer or thicker pen strokes, and have they used lighter or darker ink? So these things have been thought about. People are not as gullible as they are supposed to be. Okay, hopefully, can I get this right? We come on to objection 6. This thing we've just been discussing, other valid gospels suppressed by the Roman Catholic Church. Yes, there are other gospels, but they're not narrative accounts like the four gospels we know. Most of them are clearly Gnostic, which I'll explain in a minute. Most of them record supposed, and may include real, sayings of Jesus. For example, the Gospel of Thomas, about 160 AD, which doesn't believe in the resurrection, contains 114 secret sayings of Jesus, supposed to have been revealed only to Thomas. The New Testament synoptic Gospels are a century earlier, and the Gospel of Thomas is clearly dependent on them and displays Gnostic beliefs. Now, Gnosticism was a heresy, perhaps the biggest threat to the church in the first 2 to 3 centuries. It combined Jewish magic, Christian and Greek ideas to deny that Jesus was human. Well, some also denied that he died and others that he was resurrected. Gnostics loved mysteries and secret knowledge and thought the material world was evil. Their gospels contain post-resurrection supposed conversations between Christ and the disciples as a framework for teaching Gnostic doctrines. Salvation is by secret knowledge. Women have to become men to be saved, you might be interested to know. And some of their ideas are now found in Islam, not that last one. For example, the Gospel of Barnabas, widely read by Muslims who claim it's the only gospel written by a disciple of Jesus, but of course Barnabas wasn't a disciple. It claims Jesus didn't die, but that Judas took his place at the last minute. But we know it's a late medieval fake. Possibly Islamic. There is no manuscript copy. The earliest copy is 15th to 16th century and contains late medieval ideas and descriptions. There's no reference to it, even by Muslim writers before this time. No church father quoted it. The Gospel itself quotes from the Latin Vulgate, which was written in the 4th century, so it can't have been written by a 1st century disciple. Other Gnostic Gospels you might have heard of, the Gospel of Judas, the Apocryphon of James, the Gospel of Philip, secret sayings and strange events in all of them. And 2 different ones, the Epistle of Barnabas, which is harsh and probably not by Barnabas, but it comes from the end of the 1st century, and the Shepherd of Hermas, mid-2nd century, mostly Orthodox, and both of them were proposed for the canon, but both rejected. None of the others were even proposed. You can, if you like, compare them with the real Gospels. Original documents intending to be history capture topical detail which a later writer might leave out, such as you see in John's Gospel, which is full of inconsequential detail. It was night. It was winter. It was in Solomon's portico. John the Baptist was baptizing at Enon because there was a lot of water there. Real histories tend to be direct, factual, and concise. They're also consistent. Later versions and fabrications tend to elaborate, exaggerate, and embellish. They also tend to be more general and less specific. Objection number 7, they couldn't have accurately remembered all those events and all that teaching, so the Gospels must have arisen from the oral tradition, which was shaped by the needs of the Christian community. But Jesus and the Gospel writers used easily memorized forms, such as the chiasma. The school of Uppsala points to the Jewish oral tradition. Jesus was a rabbi, so his disciples, like Jewish disciples, would be able and would be expected to memorize accurately large quantities of information. They worked as authoritative eyewitnesses and were guardians of the truth, and they clearly regarded themselves as such. Typically, the apostles say they delivered over to others exactly what they had received, and both these terms are from the Jewish rabbinical tradition. There were also shorthand writers who could take dictation. That's not a 20th century invention. Scholars for a long time believed that the Gospels were written down late in the first century and that before then existed only in the oral tradition and could be invented freely to reflect not the facts but the needs of the Christian community. But we now know that the oral tradition is much more fixed than that, and evidence for a very early date for the material being fixed comes from Paul's writing, which we're going to look at in a minute. So what is the evidence for the Gospels being an accurate account? Well, Jesus has a distinctive voice across all the Gospels. He uses, for example, threefold sayings 64 times, such as ask, seek, knock, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody else does that. He uses other phrases not duplicated by other New Testament writers. It's only Jesus who tells parables. The other New Testament writers don't. All these things point to a genuine, unique individual and not a portrait by committee. Plus, the Gospels include material focused and practical for the Jewish churches, whereas very soon most churches were Gentile or largely Gentile. There are some minor discrepancies. There are different numbers of angels at the tomb. Matthew 27, Judas hanged himself. Acts 1, he fell headlong and burst open. But he could have done both, I suppose. But discrepancies of this kind point to real eyewitness evidence known to vary with the witness. Harder to resolve, of course, are the two accounts of Jesus' ancestry in Matthew and Luke. But we have enough eyewitnesses. 9 people wrote the New Testament. At least 6 of them were eyewitnesses, and the rest were contemporaries. In 1 Corinthians 15, it says 500 people saw Jesus alive after the resurrection, most of whom are still alive, says Paul. What he means is, if you doubt it, go and ask them. Luke says at the beginning of his gospel, having carefully investigated everything from the beginning. And Peter says, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And John says, what we have seen and heard, we proclaim. Well, were they truthful? Most of them died for it and lived lives of hardship and persecution. John Stott says, hypocrites and martyrs are not made of the same stuff. Perhaps it was fabricated a lot later. And another help here is the first century names, Jewish names in Palestine or Israel at the time. If you're a woman, there was a 25% chance you were called Mary or Salome. If you were a man, 15% of you would be called Simon or Joseph. And this is the same proportion we find in the New Testament. Jewish names, though, in Egypt at the time were different. And they were different in Israel in later centuries. So the Gospels were probably written by first century Jews living in Israel. But perhaps they could have made the whole thing up. No, they couldn't. The New Testament talks of more than 30 powerful people that we know from other documents existed. The Herods, Agrippa, Festus, Felix, Pilate, Caiaphas. They couldn't have written lies about them and got away with it. But perhaps they were prejudiced. Well, no, they had nothing to gain from their story. Persecuted, threatened, beaten, jailed, killed. And they reported material which didn't reflect on them well. The disciples argue about their position. Peter denies Jesus. They record the times they didn't understand Jesus, when he rebukes them, and times when they doubted. They include difficult and embarrassing things people said about Jesus. His own family thought him mad. Others that he was a drunkard or demon-possessed. And they left in difficult and demanding things Jesus said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, was highly offensive. Objection number 8. That Paul had a different theology from others. Paul's letters were written early, between 50 and 65 AD. Scholars therefore expected them to have an undeveloped theology, but they all show what scholars call advanced Christology. That is, Paul believes Jesus is God, and he believes this from his earliest letters to his latest letters. His theology doesn't develop over time. It's already fully developed. He was writing his letters at the same time as the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So his letters are not dependent on them, and some probably predate the gospels. Although Paul's letters are early, they contain even earlier material, creeds and hymns, which are seen to use earlier language and forms of thought Paul doesn't use himself. He received his version of the gospel before his missionary journeys started, and he checked his teaching against Peter's 3 years after his own conversion. This can't be later than AD 35 that he checked it. He checked it with Peter again 14 years later, and that can't be later, we happen to know for other reasons, from AD 49. He mentions both of these to the Galatians when he wrote to them in AD 50. All of this is evidence against a legend gradually developing and being added to, and points to a very early date for information being shared and theology having been developed. In fact, all four gospel writers, Paul and the other writers of the New Testament, have the same gospel. You can check it out. This gospel must have come from the events and teaching of Jesus' life and was rapidly agreed and codified. The gospel must have been agreed by AD 35 at the latest, if you take the crucifixion as AD 30. Objection number 9. The New Testament isn't confirmed in any of its detail by secular authors. This is just not true. Phallus, writing before 52 AD, mentions the eclipse at the time of the crucifixion in his histories. The histories are lost, but a later writer, Africanus, quotes him and says he must be wrong because it was a time of the Passover. Bar Serapion, AD 73, mentions calamities brought about through the deaths of Socrates, Pythagoras, and Jesus. Philegon, 1st century, mentions darkness at the crucifixion and refers to it as an eclipse. Josephus, a Jew living in Rome towards the end of the 1st century, who wrote the history of the fall of Jerusalem, mentions many people in the New Testament. He writes of James as the brother of the so-called Christ. He says, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man, for he wrought surprising feats. He was the Christ. When Pilate condemned him to be crucified, those who had come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared restored to life, and the tribe of Christians has not disappeared. Most scholars now accept this is by Josephus and not added by Christians later on as they first thought. It is in the earliest copies. Tacitus, writing in 112 AD, he was a major Roman historian. Talking of the fire of Rome in AD 64, he says, Nero fastened the guilt on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, which is Latin for capital punishment, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition thus checked for a moment broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. Pliny the Younger, also writing in 112 AD, wrote to the Emperor Trajan to ask how to conduct trials against those accused of Christianity, because a great multitude, he says, of every age, class, and sex stood accused of it. He says, they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a god, and bound themselves by a solemn oath not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it up. After which it was their custom to separate, and then to reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. Lucian, a 2nd century Greek satirist, talks of the new cult of Christianity. The Christians, he says, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. It was impressed upon them by their original lawgiver that they are brothers from the moment that they are converted. They deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. Suetonius, writing in 120 AD, wrote biographies of the first 12 Caesars. He said Christ was the reason the Jews were expelled from Rome in Nero's reign in 64. The Babylonian Talmud, a summary of interpretations of the law, has its most significant reference in the first bit, written between 70 and 200 AD. On the eve of Passover, Yeshua was hanged. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, "He is going to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who can say anything in his favour, let him come forward and plead on his behalf." But since nothing was brought forward, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. So here's a summary of the information we have in ancient secular manuscripts. He lived during the reign of Tiberius Caesar. He lived a virtuous life, worked miracles. He was a powerful, revered teacher. He had disciples and a brother named James. He was crucified by Pontius Pilate on the eve of Passover. When he died, darkness and an earthquake occurred. His many Jewish disciples believed that he rose from the dead and that he was the Messiah, and they were willing to die for this. They met once a week before dawn and sang a hymn to Jesus as God. They were not allowed to sin, and Christianity had spread to Rome by AD 64 and led to Jewish expulsion. In fact, probably by AD 49, the earlier expulsion was probably caused by Christianity too. So objection 10, we should not ignore the Apocrypha. Why don't we have the Apocrypha? Remember, the Septuagint included it, but in 90 AD, the Jewish Council, a Jewish council in Jamnia, excluded all writing from the Old Testament except the books the Jews and the Protestants accept today. So the Masoretic text does not have the Apocrypha. But as the Septuagint had it in it, which is Greek, the Greek Orthodox include all 14 books. Jerome at first had it in his Latin Vulgate, then he repudiated it. But Augustine, would you believe, championed it at the Council of Carthage in 397. So the Roman Catholic Church accepted 11 of the books. The King James Version and most Protestant translations used the Masoretic text for the Old Testament, which didn't have the Apocrypha. However, the 1611 King James Version had it in, and the later ones excluded it. And the Church of England, in the 39 articles, says the books of the Apocrypha are useful for example of life and instruction in manners, but are not a source of doctrine. So, summing up the whole argument, Sir Frederick Kenyon says, the Christian can take the whole Bible in his hands and say, without fear or hesitation, that he holds in it the true word of God, handed down without essential loss from generation to generation throughout the centuries. So there's a massive detail, isn't there, of why we can accept the Bible. And it's tedious, really, to sit through a lot of detail after dates and names and stuff. But the trouble is, the answer is in the detail. Do you remember at the beginning people said, it's just too much of a sweeping statement? Okay, you need to focus on the detail. Where is the evidence? Ask people for evidence. And very often it's hearsay or something they've read in strange books. Yes, it's not something that they have pursued on their own account. Let's see. Can we have three reasons why it matters that we know the Bible is reliable? Anybody give me a reason? Why does it matter?
Because it's rational.
Sorry?
You
have to be
rational.
It's based on fact. It's important to us that it's based on fact. You can only reason if you've got facts. You can't reason really with abstract nothings.
You can't know Jesus outside of the Bible.
I'm sorry?
You can't know Jesus outside of the Bible.
Yes. You need the Bible to know Jesus. For most people, I think occasionally people who don't have any access to the Bible get a vision or a dream, but for most of us, we get our discipleship in and our walk with Jesus through
without
the Bible.
Without it, we just have an oral tradition.
Sorry?
Without it, we just have an oral tradition.
Just an oral tradition without it.
Which could have been varied. The very fact that we can look...
We can trace the...
We can trace and say, I'm still believing the original thing. And as Paul said, if Christ wasn't risen from the dead, most to be pitied. And, my faith is in vain. So, basically, I just don't want to trust rubbish.
Okay, so we can trace where our Bible comes from. And we can trace most of the steps. Anything else, Rachel?
You've got to be clear what it is you believe.
Yes, it makes it clear what it is you believe. And I think that's the thing I started with. What this should do, I'm not expecting you to remember, you know, the Third Synod of Carthage in 397 AD and who was there and whatnot. Just know that you can be confident the Bible is true. Because if you can be confident the Bible is true, you can be confident that when you're spreading Christianity to your friends, you're not spreading them rubbish or misleading them. Okay.